Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hi, folks. Wonderful, wonderful audience. Best in the world. Folks from all over the world working to reform and improve psychiatry and psychology and the theoretical and the practical and the therapeutic. And increasingly, and you'll find out today why, increasingly more and more, healthcare in general, understanding what makes for healthy living, moving into the area of medicine in general, which you will be hearing about today, about the broadening of my interests through the broadening of my dear friend Pam Popper. Pam, are you there?
I am here. I'm with you.
Oh, that is so, so good. Well, let me say a few more things and then introduce you some more.
All right. Sounds like a plan.
Folks, I'm really working on reaching out more and more. I've even put off writing for the time being. I'm not doing a lot of writing right now because my big interest is, first of all, I'm doing some, it's very important legal work, but my big interest is reaching out. My website is now enormously improved, and it has on it my frequent alerts by Dr. Peter Bregan, in which you can keep up with what's going on. For example, I, for the first time ever, advertised my radio show on my website for this week, announcing Pam Popper. Very fitting. She should be the one whose show I first describe. And I have a second alert out as well, all within about 5 days. And I'm going to try to do it a little bit more than once a week anyway, to get out an alert to you directly. Interestingly, I still have to use my assistant because I haven't taken the time to do it, learn how to do it myself. But I built into this system is I'm going to be able to just sit down myself and just put out a comment to you any time of the day or night I happen to be awake, to keep you alert to what I'm doing, my latest work in the psychiatry and psychology and the law, writings and blogs, but in many ways, more importantly, keep you in touch with some of the best and the vast amount of growing numbers of folks who are getting interested in and are writing about and doing very good work in the field of psychiatric reform. And now, as I add to my interests, Pam Popper's work in nutrition, it's a really great thing. Let me tell you a little bit about Pam's background. She's been on a few times. Remember, you can go to my website, Bregan.com. And by the way, you can now get really updated every day, almost, my resource centers. One's called 123 Antidepressants. Then there's 123 Antipsychotics and 123 ECT. You can actually get to them by doing the HTTP, whatever that thing is, and just using the URL of 123antipsychotics.com or 123ect.com or 123antidepressants.com. Today we did a big update on antidepressants, and we're going to keep on just doing these updates. And you can also get to my radio show, and then it'll get you to a place where you can look up all my guests I've ever had, a few hundred of them. Several hundred of them in alphabetical order, see how many times everybody's been on. And after you hear Pam today, you may want to go on and just listen to all of her shows. So I'm just doing a lot to outreach. And one of the main inspirers of my outreaching is the woman you're about to hear from, Pam Popper. Pam has a PhD in nutrition. She got a medical degree as a naturopath, and I don't think she found that any more inspiring, or maybe even less inspiring than medicine, the regular allopathic medicine. She can comment on that. But she's really become a world's expert on nutrition for good health and nutrition for the treatment of illness and disease. And she knows pretty much more medicine than anybody I know, including people who are practicing general medicine, because she's just been researching information, because her big goal through her Wellness Forum Health, Pam Popper's big goal is to provide informed medical decision making. And she got excited about me and my work, because basically I'm trying to work in the area of informed psychiatric decision making and medical psychiatric drug decision making. So Pam is inspiring me to do so much more. And in a few months, we're going to have up a huge course that you can take on how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. Through Pam's college. Yes, Pam is creating a college. So there's so much to say about Pam. I'm going to skip it all. Give the mic to my dear, dear friend, Pam Popper, PhD, ND. That's for naturopathy. And let her talk. You've just been inspiring my life lately.
Well, you have inspired mine, and I think it's important that we bring together all of the people who have this same idea that consumers have a right to be fully informed before they make a decision about anything in medicine. And, you know, when you think about it, this is not an unusual concept. In fact, the federal government requires all kinds of disclosures. If you've been through this, you go buy a house. You can't sign the mortgage until you fill out all these things saying you've been fully informed about the rate and the default and what happens if you miss a payment, all this stuff, to buy a house, to sign a mortgage. And it's appalling to me that no such disclosures are required before somebody undergoes a major surgery or takes a life-altering drug. And we have to make this right, because what I hear in my office every day, and I think you probably hear your fair share of it too, is if I'd known then what I know now, I never would have, and then you can fill in the blank. I never would have taken this drug. I never would have gone to that person. I never would have had this test. I never would have had this procedure, adopted this diet, taken this. I wouldn't have done any of these things if I'd known. And so we have to get to the place where people know sooner rather than later, so that you and I don't spend our days dealing with regretful people who never had any idea what they were signing up for when they took a big leap and got sucked into what I call the medical mill.
Absolutely, Pam. And what stuns me is how far beyond nutrition you've gone, and how practical, honorable, rational, and scientific you are. Pam, for example, folks, let me tell you a little about why I'm finally working with a nutritionist. I'll tell you about some of the bad experiences. Almost everybody that I was invited to speak at their conferences or invited to share ideas with them, who called themselves a nutritionist, was selling some kind of cockamamie supplement, something that would fix yourself. And I remember saying to one person with whom I had some general agreement, saying to them, oh, look, the one thing I'm so glad about, this was a person that had, it was thousands of people in their audience and potential people for me to keep communicating with. I'm so glad you haven't come up with getting a nutritionist involved who's going to tell you take this for your dopamine and this for your serotonin and this will cure your this and that mental problem. And then right in the middle of it, there he's got somebody hawking his book that he's now hired to say all this nonsense I'm standing there looking at this nutritionist while she's telling somebody that she's just met at the table that they have a dopamine imbalance and to take this or that nutritional supplement, which, by the way, she sells. So this is Pam. I haven't talked to Pam about this much, but this is why I was a little hesitant in the beginning, I guess, but why I've not met anybody until you. And folks, what Pam is doing is good nutrition. And she's not even an absolute vegan, which I thought you were going to be. I mean, you might be for yourself. I don't know. But she's in favor of a little bit of meat. If you want to have a little bit of meat, just make sure it's really healthy meat. And she tells you what healthy meat is going to be like. It's not going to be what you usually buy in the store. And she talks about a basic vegetable diet. Not only vegetables, but a basic plant diet, which expands it, of course, much wider. The one thing that I'm interested in about Pam is that she has said no, no, no about is dairy, and everything I learn about dairy tells me Pam is right. So Pam is a sensible person, not a doctrinaire person, and she does sell some good foods, but they're foods. And she's not making up that you can't get good foods elsewhere. Hi, Pam. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, and you brought up some things I think are important to discuss. I mean, you brought up a lot of really good points that I talk about often. And I think the first thing is you mentioned that what I do and what we do here goes far beyond nutrition. And that really happened as a result of my first 6 months operating a business and finding out that I think diet is extremely important. I don't see people getting better without eating a better diet, but it's not a healthcare system. And to suggest, you know, I write extensively, and I learned about this issue of reductionism from my good friend and colleague, Colin Campbell at Cornell University. And so to tell people who are heavily medicated and they've been sucked into the medical mill, which I mentioned earlier, that you just start eating plants and all of your problems will go away is very disingenuous, and it's a form of reductionism I think we can't afford. And that's why very early on I broadened what I did and what we do here to informed medical decision making, which means looking at every aspect of healthcare, looking at risks and benefits and making smarter decisions, sometimes in retrospect, pulling yourself out of the medical mill, but certainly before you do anything else. I think the second thing is that I've written extensively about this issue. If the paradigm is wrong, then changes within the same paradigm will also be wrong. So let's think about the way that medicine approaches health. Give me a symptom, I'll give you a drug. Well, naturopathy approaches health the same way. Give me a symptom, I'll give you a supplement. And nutritionists many times focus on that same thing. Give me a symptom, I'll give you a supplement. And so this is a major thing we've got to get away from. We've got to start dealing with causes, not symptoms, because that's the only way you can really hope to help somebody. And last but not least, I think that we have to get away from developing, taking this approach of starting a private club. That's really what I call it, where I make some certain choices about the way I want to live my life. And for the record, I eat a vegan diet, but there certainly isn't any science that suggests everybody needs to eat a vegan diet. So you have a choice when you're in a position like mine. You can start a business called I Want to Be Like Pam. And so you recruit people who want to live like me, and we call it a private club, and isn't that fun? Or you can say, listen, I'm a scientist, and I'm going to draw a line in the sand here. And my personal choices, while they might be interesting to other people, have nothing to do with what they should do based on the totality of their lives and their value system. And so I think there are some very clear guidelines that should guide the type of diet that humans eat, because you know diets are species specific. But having said that, to suggest that everybody has to do exactly what I do in order to achieve optimal health would be disingenuous. It's not scientific. And we're not going to gain traction with people by doing things that in the long run appear to be deceptive or disingenuous. So I know that sounds a little bit arrogant because, you know, it makes it sound like we really have we have carved out this space for ourselves and selves, and we're different than everybody else. But we really are different from everybody else. I think informed medical decision-making is a niche in and of itself. We invented it. We occupy it. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud to differentiate ourselves from a lot of other people who I think are well-intentioned but maybe not doing the best for people.
Yeah, you are really unique. I know that when one of my friends who's a physician, got very interested before she knew you in nutritional issues, and she ended up going to some of the big conferences on nutrition, and they kind of looked like the big medical conferences, except the concessions were selling supplements and other forms of magic rather than pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
And she was very disappointed as a scientist and physician. So you are quite unique within the field. And I'm just so glad that God put us together.
Me too.
And that, you know, because I'm learning so much from you and I'm healthier because of you. By the way, folks, so the first 6 weeks after I went on a basic plant, I would say for me, plant-oriented diet, I lost 15 pounds and a lot of stomach issues just got a lot better. And I'm 81. I have mild blood pressure, which I'm told is natural for my age by everybody I talk to except Pam. And Pam, the blood pressure's going down. I take one little tiny dose a day, but it's going down. I foresee not needing it. I've got some asthma, which I viewed as coming on with old age, but boy, has that gotten better. So, you know, maybe I'll have a lot of improvement in my health, maybe not, but I'm certainly losing weight and feeling better, and the trend is toward a lot of improvement in health. And it just makes sense to eat this way. You know, Pam and I both, we have so much in common. We're both very interested in evolution. Maybe you could talk some about where your science comes from, Pam, from evolution, from Colin Campbell's studies, from your own work. Talk about the science a bit, would you?
Yeah, and the first thing I want to say about the science, I have to say something first. You mentioned you've learned so much from me. I've learned so much from you. I quote you every day in this office, just so you know. I had somebody in here yesterday who has a lot of problems, physical problems and mental health issues and all kinds of things going on. And of course, she's very upset. And I said, well, the first thing I want to tell you is this is normal. I said, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Peter Bregan, says it's hard being a human. And she laughed, which was great because she needed to laugh. I don't think this woman had laughed for a long time. And I was talking to her about your philosophy of life and how these kinds of issues come up when you're dealing with other humans, when you're trying to be a good human and deal with other humans. And so I quote you all the time, and I really think this partnership is based on so many things, including learning from each other so we can both be better at what we do. And I appreciate you every day in this office when I deal with people. So, but I want to talk about this issue of evidence because I wrote an article not too long ago. It's called My Study, Your Study, My Expert, Your Expert. And this is where a lot of the confusion comes from. So here's the way the dialogue normally goes, all right? It goes something like this. I advocate a plant-based diet, and here are some studies showing that it's a good idea. And then somebody else says, well, I advocate a paleo diet, and I have some studies too. And so now it looks to the consumer as if this is all very confusing. And actually, it's not confusing if we have some criteria for evaluating the evidence. All right. And so I'll come back to that in a second, but I always teach through analogies. And so my analogy in this situation is think what the confusion would be like if when we played football, when we had football on Monday night, there were no rules of the game. All right. So I'm 60 years old. I weigh 128 pounds and I decide I want to play football. I'm in. And one team has 60 players. The other team has 25 because there are no rules. All right. And then the way that this works is we run up and down the field for a couple of hours, and at the end, you know, we stop and we have some commentators who then decide, based on no rules, who won the football game. And those commentators don't really have to be anybody in particular. We have a couple of people qualified, like Urban Meyer, who coaches the local Ohio State team, and, you know, maybe an NFL coach. But then we have an accountant in Atlanta. He just loves football. He's allowed to be on the team. Now, you can see what happens here. When there are no rules for who is an expert, when there are no rules that govern what is a valid study, and everything is created equal, you have massive confusion, all right? So in our world, the first thing we have to do, and we do this with our patients and clients here, is we have to teach people rules for evaluating evidence. And so when you look at the, when you set some rules and you say, look, we have to have studies that show long-term outcomes. And we have to look at patterns of behavior, diet and lifestyle habits over long periods of time. And this has to be impartial data. And it can't be just correlation. You have to have a cause and effect relationship, and a mechanism of action has to be identified. And some people listening to this might think, oh my gosh, they're already losing me. But these are concepts that can be taught to people pretty easily, just like people can understand when they sign a mortgage what all that language means before they sign their name to the dotted line. You're going to pay $785 a month, right? So we can teach that. But my point is that when we start looking at the evidence with some rules, what becomes really apparent is that humans are designed to eat a plant-based diet. So let's start in the present. The human saliva contains a predominance of amylase, which is an enzyme that digests starch, not enzymes that digest protein and fat, but amylase that digests starch. This is a hint that we are starch eaters. We have very long intestinal tracts, which means that we need an enormous amount of fiber to push the food through. Carnivorous creatures like lions have really short intestinal tracts, which is why they can eat enormous amounts of animal food. It doesn't have to travel very far. So from an anatomical standpoint, humans are starch eaters. But I'll tell you what's even more interesting. A lot of times the folks who advocate these meat-based diets insist that back in the days of being paleo, whatever that means, the paleo era, humans were eating a lot of animal food, and one of the things they rely on is the finding of bones at the campsite. Well, let's face it, at the campsite, how many thousands of years or millions of years later, you're not going to see the remnants of cabbage hanging around. You'll see the remnants of animal bones, and we did eat some animal food. But we now have this very interesting thing that we can do, which is analyzing the plaque on the teeth of Neanderthals and very ancient people. And you know what we find in the plaque? These people were starch eaters. Neanderthals were starch eaters. So this goes back a very, very long time. This is not a new idea. We have always eaten plants. And I laugh sometimes at the suggestion that early man, who was a tree dweller and weighed about 60 pounds with no weaponry, was somehow able to run and chase after large wild animals, kill them without weaponry, and then somehow haul that back to the campsite to share with the rest of the crowd. It just is implausible. It's absolutely ridiculous to think about. In fact, if you take a look at the fastest runners on the planet today, the people who are winning marathons, Olympic marathons, New York City Marathon, they don't run fast enough to accomplish this. All right. So the fact that back then, or the thought that back then this was going on, is insane. So this is the type of evidence that you rely on. It starts with the archaeological evidence of how people lived and what they ate, and goes right on up to today. We can look at the map of the world and see where disease incidence is high. It's not in Northern Africa where they're eating a lot of tubers. It's not in rural China where they're eating rice. And it's not in Okinawa where they live on sweet potatoes. It's in the United States, Australia, Norway, westernized countries where we eat a lot of animal food. That's where the incidence of disease is very, very high. So that's a smattering of the evidence. But my gosh, we have 3,500 hours of educational programming here that deals with that and all kinds of other issues like medications and all that sort of thing too.
It might help for folks to make a distinction that became clearer and clearer to me, which is that in cultures that are not modernized, there may be malaria killing people early. There may be other dysenteries and other illnesses that are coming from poor sanitation, or lack of antibiotics. But if you look at what is killing people in the United States, Great Britain, and in the cities of China, not the countryside, then you start looking at heart disease and diabetes and cardiovascular disease in general and so on. And I'd like you to list some of those because you know so much more than I do. Those are hugely increased. And the evidence seems very, very strong that it's increased by the eating aspect of modern life. Is that a correct assessment?
Absolutely. And what you're talking about is differentiating between diseases of affluence and diseases of poverty. Diseases of poverty are
talk
infectious diseases and that sort of thing. Diseases of affluence are diseases of diet and lifestyle excess, essentially. And we have such clear evidence for this. And I'll give you some macro examples, and I'll give you one specific example that's just mind-blowing. So the first thing is that, as I mentioned, you can look at a map of the world and where you see the high disease incidences in westernized countries. But then an interesting facet of this is if somebody, let's say, who lives in Japan, where health statistics are significantly better than here, going downhill, by the way, because everybody wants to be a Westerner, but they're still better than here. When people from Japan, for example, move to the United States, within 15 years, they duplicate our obesity and disease rates. Now, people like to attribute some of this stuff to genetics, but I always ask people, do you think when folks are flying over the Pacific Ocean, someplace at 35,000 mile altitude, there's a change in their genes? It switches by the time they land in California. No, they get off the plane, they go to Starbucks, they go to KFC. This is the problem. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we have wonderful studies on identical twins. And what you see is when they grow up in the same household, their health statistics are pretty similar because they live the same way. And then when they grow into adulthood, and many times their habits become wildly divergent, and you see a huge divergence in their disease rates. And then we have the Pima Indians, which are a very interesting population. Some of the Pima live in Mexico. Some live in Arizona. In many instances, these are members of the same family living in different places. And the Mexican Pima Indians still eat a very plant-centered diet. It's low in fat. They're very physically active people. They still primarily do farming and manual labor for a living. The Arizona Pima, on the other hand, remember genetically the same family in some instances. These are people who are living a much more Americanized lifestyle, Americanized diet, a lot of animal food, fat, protein, not as physically active. The type 2 diabetes rate in the Arizona Pima is 38%. It's 6% in the Mexican Pima. 38% versus 6%. This is an astounding statistic. It's going on right now. It's happening right in the southwest part of our country. And so it is crystal clear. And we could look at 300 studies like that that are easily accessible where we see this very clear delineation that is habit-oriented. And of course, you have people that argue with this because they're trying to promote a point of view. But actually, this is very important information for people. And one of the reasons being that most of the time, when people end up sick in a doctor's office, and they often ask this question, why is this happening to me? Here's what they hear from their doctors. It's genetic. Your father had diabetes, so you do too. In your case, it's age. As people get older, of course, they start to crumble. People are living longer than they used to. That's the issue, which they're really not. We can talk about that. But people are actually not supposed to fall apart as they age. So you get the aging thing, you get the genetics thing, and you get the just bad luck. As if you're walking down the street one day and God decides he doesn't like you, so you get lupus, all right? Well, all of this makes people feel like a helpless victim, because if it really is bad luck, if it really is genes, if it really is age, there's nothing you can do about that. I didn't get to pick my genes. I'm definitely getting older, and I can't control what happens to me when I walk down the sidewalk if somebody has it in for me for that day. But if I really understand that this is my diet and lifestyle habits that are going to determine my outcomes for the most part, then I get the control back. I'm no longer a helpless victim. And that's another thing I'm incredibly motivated to do, in addition to the informed medical decision-making, is making people understand that they are in control of their health outcomes, just like they're in control of so many other things in their lives. And it's a very empowering feeling.
I want to go on next, maybe to the study in China, which is so impressive, involving I guess, tens of millions of people. But first, I want to tell folks about something I've mentioned before that you can find on our website, my website, and Pam Popper's website. And that is that there's a conference. And I'm joining Pam now at her annual conferences. I've been at two. And this year, for the first time, I'm actually officially putting the name on it of being co-sponsored by our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, which dovetails precisely with the, you know, sensible nutrition and healthy nutrition. And the conference is November 10th, I think, through the 12th. I think that's the correct dates.
Yeah.
And as a part of my co-sponsoring, Pam is really wonderful. My co-sponsoring just means that I'm going to help advertise it, and I have a small part in organizing it, very small. And my part in organizing it is that I'm going to give a talk, and two people you've heard on my radio show, and if you are at all into psychiatric reform, one of them you will know extremely well. And that's Peter Goetze is going to be there, the great Danish physician, Peter Goetze, who is a fabulous speaker. He's the only speaker who's extremely scientific that I know of, who's more inflammatory than I am. And we're both just scientists at heart, but, you know, I admire him. He sometimes says things in a better way than I do. And then Jeannie Stolzer, who is a professor who specializes in child development, and she's an expert in the importance of early relationships, of nursing, the importance of nursing. We got to deal with these issues, the importance of a strong bond with one healthcare provider, one nurturer, with one nurturer, usually a mother. Not always, but usually a mother. So we're going to be dealing with tough and hard issues. You know, I mean, nursing is controversial. Having to have one single loving, devoted nurturer for the first few years of your life is controversial. But it's not if you look at evolution and science. So I'm getting into a broader area. So Jeannie Stolzer is going to be talking at the conference. And you can go online, just look up Pam Popper, or go online to Bragan.com, and you'll see my upcoming events. And get ready for the conference. Put some time aside for the November 10, 11, 12 conference. And I can tell you, Pam's conferences are usually sold out or close to sold out, and I'm hoping that between the two of us it probably will be sold out, and then we'll have to move to a larger venue the following year.
And won't that be so awful, right? How fun that will be.
Do you have anything to add
about the conference? What's that? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Add a few words about the conference, and there are people there who I've heard speak, but I don't know them the way you do.
Oh, you're gonna enjoy meeting some of these other people. So the theme of our conference is informed medical decision making, and some of the other speakers will include Dr. Richard Ablin, who is I like people who are scientists. I really, at this point in time, I guess you could say I've become a science snob. I want to talk to people who understand rules for evaluating science. I mean, you can find a study to document anything you want to say, but that's not what this is all about. It's about the preponderance of the evidence and good practices in research. So Dr. Richard Ablin is an interesting guy. He is the researcher who discovered prostate-specific antigen, which is not a marker for cancer. It is not a marker for cancer. This shocks people. But he's the author of an amazing book called The Great Prostate Hoax, and he's going to talk about it. He had been a speaker a couple years ago and talked about his discovery and how it has been misused by drug and device makers and a lot of other people in the medical field. But this time he's going to talk about immunotherapy, and he and I share some of the same ideas. In fact, I wrote an article about immunotherapy, and we had a little bit of dialogue about that. So he's going to talk about immunotherapy and how that is grossly misunderstood by doctors who are administering it, actually. Eileen Kopsaftis, who you're going to spend some time with shortly, is our physical therapy guru and business partner, and she's going to talk about her techniques and how she resolves pain and restores function without drugs or surgery in most people. What this woman does is miraculous, and you're going to get a chance to experience this yourself in just a few days here. And then Dr. Janice Fanger, who is an expert in aging and also nutrition, she'll be giving a talk. So we have an all-star lineup, and people will hear about all kinds of things, ranging from psychiatry to child rearing to cancer treatment to restoring musculoskeletal function to diet, and on and on. So there's something there for everybody, and the totality of it is a package that I don't think is presented anyplace else in the United States. I don't know anybody who puts on a conference like we do.
No, and it, you know, I think together, and especially with your ability to reach out, the skills you bring, entrepreneurial skills, this could be the beginning of real change in medical care. I had invited you to talk about the China study, but let's maybe not. Let's get expansive. And the science, folks, Pam has tons of it and on her website, and you can follow that up more. You can take courses with her and so on. But let's talk more expansively about what you're looking at in terms of becoming a health delivery system. You're on the way, and talk about what you, where you are so far, but what your goals are, which are stunning. As you said to me in a recent conversation, if you achieve one-tenth of your goals, you're going to change the world. Let's hear, tell folks what you're looking at.
Okay. Well, I have to first say I had really good parents. You might wonder what this has to do with it, but my parents were very successful people. And my father in particular was very successful in business by looking at systems, the way things are done, and thinking, gosh, if we did it differently, we could really make a big difference. And he did. My father was quite the innovator. Different discussion for a different day. But I just want to say that that's where I learned to think the way that I think about healthcare. And so I've been in this business for 21 years. And I've been battling upstream. It's gotten easier lately because I have a following, because I've been fortunate to be in some documentaries and to write some books that got a lot of attention. And life just gets easier when you don't have so many people taking shots at you as used to. But in any case, as I've watched this whole thing with healthcare, and I've been involved with it in so many ways. I've been a lobbyist. I've helped change laws in different states. I've been a provider. I've done this from a number of different perspectives. What I've seen is that I think that the medical system is today where the automobile business was a few decades ago. And everybody who's listening to this may not remember. This tells you how old I am, because I remember. I remember when there were three big automakers in Detroit that made cars, most of the cars sold in the United States. And they had a corner on the market. And they charged too much for the cars. They weren't really all that well made. They were expensive. And the systems were so bloated in these companies that produced cars that it used to take General Motors 17 signatures to change the paint color on a model. This is ludicrous. And so other car makers in other countries looked at this and said, boy, those Americans, they all drive cars. And we think we can make better cars, we can make them less expensive, and we can be much more nimble than those American car makers. And they came in here like little stealth invaders. And what happened is they took over the industry, so much so that the automobile companies have gone bankrupt on a couple of different occasions. The whole city of Detroit went bankrupt, and it still is recovering. And so I think the reason I tell that story, healthcare is today where the automobile business was when the foreign car makers came in here. It's very precarious. You have a system that is financially unsustainable. You have consumers who have an increasing appetite for finding out things, who are increasingly suspicious of authority figures, ranging from politicians to medical doctors, who are looking online for alternatives, and they're not just doing what people tell them to do anymore. They're becoming kind of rebellious and difficult to control as medical consumers. Many of them are feeling like healthcare is expensive, they don't understand it, they're not getting better, they're getting worse. And so, and the providers don't like it any better. I mean, you and I are very spoiled. We operate our own thing. We do our own thing. We control our own time. We decide who we're going to see and what we're going to charge. And life is pretty sweet for you and I. But our colleagues, often our good colleagues, they hate the environment they're working in. So if you have a $3.2 trillion business that is built, that is bloated and expensive and inept, and it's not based on evidence, and the consumers hate it and the providers hate it, I'm looking at this from the outside and saying this is certainly ripe for disruption. Somebody is going to come in and do something that turns this upside down. And I think we're the people to do it. And I know that sounds arrogant. And when I said I was going to do this in 2014, people looked at me like I had really developed some rare form of delusional thinking. Maybe I was becoming psychotic. Maybe I needed some drugs at that point. But what I was looking at is this, and these are the circumstances that I think make it ripe for a company like us to do it. The first thing is that the type of change that we're talking about, where consumers are fully informed before they make a decision to do something, it will never come from within large medical institutions. And the reason is it's bad for business. So, for example, take any, most medical institutions make their money on bypass surgery and angioplasty. Well, at the Cleveland Clinic, I think they charge $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 for angioplasty and bypass surgery. You know, Dr. Esselstyn, a colleague of mine, has helped terminal cardiovascular patients stay alive for 30 years past their terminal diagnosis with diet. He charges under $1,000 to do it. So if the Cleveland Clinic started sending all the heart patients to Esselstyn, they'd have to start closing down buildings on that facility. That's never going to happen. Kaiser's not going to do it. No medical institution, because they're all interested in self-preservation, is going to go into a process of self-liquidation. So this has to come from outside. It has to be a force from outside. It also has to be a force from outside that understands this marketplace and has considerable resources, and we do. We have 3,500 hours of programming and 2,500 articles that facilitate informed decision-making. And while you and I are having this conversation, my colleagues are creating more of it. We grow every day. And this is an information-based method of healthcare. And so he who controls the information will control the market eventually, because that's what consumers are looking for. They don't need somebody else to tell them what to do. They need somebody to help them sort out all the stuff they've already been told to do, much of which, if not most, is ill-advised. So our plan, just to kind of cut to the chase here, is to take all of this and develop an alternative healthcare system that does everything except inpatient care, at least as I see it now, which means that people enter our system, they use our assessment tools, they use our interventions for musculoskeletal issues, chronic degenerative issues, psychological issues. They are taken care of by healthcare providers we train through our school. They attend or go visit clinics that we set up. We believe we'll be in the clinic building business next year. And that eventually, and depends on a lot about what happens with healthcare on a national basis, they will actually be insured by us. And we think that if we do this, we can siphon off about 10% of that bloated $3.2 trillion business, which would put us in a pretty powerful position to influence other aspects of healthcare. And I have a lot of those in mind. So that's the big plan. And like I said, in 2014, I think people just looked at me and thought, poor child, I hope she, you know, stops taking those bad drugs she's taking that make her psychotic or delusional. But I think right now, after everything we've done in the last few years, people are seeing we're doing it. It's not anymore if we do it. We're doing it. And that's one of the reasons I approached you to become a partner. It's one of the reasons Eileen Kopsaftis became a partner, and others have joined us. We're now doing this type of intervention work in corporations. I took you to one of our sites when you were here. So this is all starting to happen, and it's doable. It's very doable. We're doing it. So that's the plan.
What do you think, folks? I wish I could hear all your responses out there, but because I have such wonderful guests, I tend not to take, I don't take any phone calls. But today it would be fun to have some interaction. I don't take callers, Pam. well, it's incredibly exciting, of course, to be working with you. Now, your ultimate goal is to actually have, as I understand it from our conversations, clinics that are full service. They will provide first line, the first option to help people will be drug-free psychotherapy and drug-free nutrition, and there'll be no drug therapy offered at all for psychiatric issues, but there will be other physicians working within the group who, where medication is appropriate, and obviously if referral for surgery is appropriate, that will take place. But these doctors will be trained to understand what a small percentage of actual illnesses, physical illnesses, are really helped by drugs. I had an interesting response in that regard. I was talking to a very well-known Harvard physician, and highly specialized physician, but not in psychiatry, and who works within a conventional system. And I asked him what percentage of current medications that are being given actively to patients are useful. And he said 5%.
He's
which
right.
I just thought was amazing coming from him, because he's not on cutting edge reform in the same sense you and I are. So I think you're going to get and we'll be getting increasing agreement from physicians that they want to learn about drug-free approaches to mind and body, and where appropriate drug-free approaches to the body. Is that kind of a good summary of what your clinics will be like?
It is. I'll add a couple of things that I think are important. The first thing is we don't want to forget the musculoskeletal issues, which is 30% of our health care bill every year. So the people who have knee injuries, by the way, arthroscopic surgery, new article just published today, no difference 2 years out. Surgery versus no surgery. I mean, what we do to people from an orthopedic perspective is ridiculous, and most of those problems are fixed without drugs and surgery. But we have to back it up even further. What these doctors, and we have physician training programs right now, we're training, when I say we're doing it, we are doing it. We're training doctors right now to exercise judgment in all areas of medicine, and this starts with diagnostic testing, most of which is useless, PSA testing, mammography, thyroid scans. I mean, all this stuff is useless. Another thing we have to do is we have to restore clinical judgment. There has been a trend in medicine, which I am extremely opposed to, which is to treat humans as if they're machines. In other words, if the human has a blood test result that says X, then you go to the operations manual for humans, and this is what you do to that person without any consideration for their particular health status or age or anything else. So, you know, people send me these emails, and they say, well, I got a blood test at my doctor's office, and, you know, this number is a little out of whack. What do you think? And I write back, I don't have any idea. I don't know anything about you. I don't know if that's something to be concerned about or not. But we've lost all clinical judgment in terms of medicine. We don't understand anymore, when I say we, the collective we. We don't differentiate between the need for diagnostic tests to determine when something is wrong versus testing everybody for everything to find any abnormality and then do something about it, when sometimes these people would be better off not even knowing. We've lost track of the idea that the smaller the abnormality, the less likely people will benefit from doing anything about it anyway. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with number needed to treat. I look at number needed to treat on some of these issues. You know, 165 people have to take a drug for 7 years for one person to benefit. This is insanity. It's one of the reasons the bill is so bloated, and it's one of the reasons why patients are being over-treated and why they're getting sicker instead of better. I think there are entire books being written now on this idea of too much medicine making us sicker instead of better. So a good physician, in my opinion, is one that looks at each individual person as an individual and says, listen, this person's blood test result, it says one thing about this individual, then the same results say about another individual, depending upon their health status and all kinds of other things, and that you don't just test people until you find something wrong, and you don't medicate every abnormality and that sort of thing. And so if you take a look at what's wrong in medicine, another overarching thing you can say is that if we only use the tools we have for the people for whom they are appropriate, you could cut the healthcare bill by 2/3. And you wouldn't be over-diagnosing and over-treating people. The reason why it doesn't happen inside the system is it's too lucrative to stop doing everything to everybody. So we want people staffing our clinics who exercise good clinical judgment, and that's gone today. And it's a shame. It's because people used to be able to trust their doctors to have collaborative discussions with them, and doctors knew their patients and made recommendations accordingly. That doesn't go on anymore.
Well, you know, now, of course, in psychiatry and medicine, what's done is you have a little algorithm that's actually in a computer, and you poke in a few symptoms and outcomes, diagnosis and a drug, or you just put in the diagnosis that you guess or think and outcomes the drugs, and you have no idea what the financial interests are that are influencing that computer program, except you have
huge.
To know they're monumental.
They're huge.
It's so remote from clinical judgment.
Oh, yeah, and I'll tell you how, one of the ways in which this is things are changing and have changed in this area that's absolutely frightening. The drug companies now are pretty much setting the diagnostic parameters for disease. So let me give you an example of how this plays out in real life. So it used to be, not too long ago, if your fasting blood glucose was over 140, you had a stern discussion with your doctor about you better change your ways because you're pretty much going to become a diabetic soon if you're not already there. And if it isn't different by the next time I see you, I'm going to put you on metformin, okay? Well, the drug companies have gotten involved. You know, the committees that set the diagnostic parameters, pretty much drug reps. And so the criteria changed a few years ago to 126. Now it was fasting glucose at 126. Well, that day, 13 million more people in this country qualified to have that discussion, only it wasn't anymore by the next visit if things aren't better. It's like you're starting metformin today. Then it got dropped to 100. There's some labs that use 80. Well, what's happening is as you ratchet down those diagnostic parameters, you keep sweeping up more and more people who if they had been tested, you know, last week, they would have been fine. This week, they're labeled with disease. This has happened with hypothyroidism. It's happened with blood pressure. It's happened with, you know, in the UK, they don't treat hypertensive patients unless their blood pressure reaches 160 over 100 and does not respond to diet and lifestyle change and weight loss. In this country, we now call people at 110 over 70 pre-hypertensive. That's the influence of the drug companies because the lower the diagnostic parameters, the more people you can drug. And so, and this is the unfortunate part about it. Medical training is so bad, and mine was no better as naturopath. Medical training is so bad that the vast majority of doctors who are passing out the drugs don't realize that the parameters are set by drug companies and they're drugging people who are perfectly fine.
Yeah, and one of the big ones that, you know, just in passing you didn't mention is the cholesterol hoax. I mean, they keep lowering that. And the cholesterol drugs, as far as I can tell, were never shown to be life-saving at all unless you had approximately a 500 cholesterol.
Well, there's a bigger issue there, and that is that we're treating symptoms, not cause. Okay, so here's the thing. If you take Crestor because your cholesterol is high, you reduce your cholesterol to a low number, and we keep prescribing bigger doses of the drugs. Now the big thing is 80 milligrams instead of 20 milligrams of Lipitor. 80, four times the dose, because it's good for you to have the lowest LDL you can possibly have and low total cholesterol. But just the standard dose of cholesterol-lowering meds, the average reduction in the risk of stroke, heart attack, or all-cause mortality is 0.7%. So you have pretty blood work because you're treating a surrogate marker. Nobody has ever had a death certificate issued, cause of death, high cholesterol. High cholesterol is a marker for coronary artery disease. If you treat the cholesterol but you don't treat the underlying damage to the endothelial cells that line the blood vessels, if you're not treating the coronary artery disease, you haven't changed the person's health outcome at all. So we have this new thing going on in our country. It's called people dying with great blood work. Their lab work looks great, but their actual health status is awful. And that's what happened to Tim Russert, you know, the beloved anchorman who had that Sunday morning show. He was 58 years old. He had a fatal heart attack at the age of 58, knocked him out right away. And he had seen one of the best, and I put air quotes around that, internists in New York City 6 weeks before his heart attack, signed off perfect health. You know why? Because he was taking a statin drug. He was taking a drug for his blood pressure. He was taking a daily aspirin, and he was taking a drug for his pre-diabetic condition. So he had pretty blood work, awful health. None of that addressed what killed him. Miles of rotting arteries lined with unstable plaques, and one of them ruptured, and that's the way he died. So the point is that the problem with cholesterol is not that we shouldn't pay attention to it. It's pretty crystal clear that people with low cholesterol, and the definition of low is the operant thing here, but people with low cholesterol have considerably lower risk of heart attack. But all roads of lowering your cholesterol do not lead to the same place. Lowering it with drugs is not the same as lowering your cholesterol with diet. When you do it with diet, you're truly protected. That's how Caldwell Esselstyn has kept these people alive. You know, he has the longest longitudinal study of heart patients ever been conducted, 31 years and running. And his original patients, five of them were supposed to be dead in 1985, given a terminal diagnosis. The first one died last year. She lives 31 years past her diagnosis, and the other four are still alive. That's how he's kept them alive, is lowering their cholesterol with diet instead of drugs and repairing that endothelial tissue that lines the arteries. That's treating the disease, not the marker for the disease.
How would people get Forks Over Knives? There's a movie out. It's now been – it's an aged movie now. It's been around a while, hasn't it, Pam, Forks Over Knives?
Yeah.
How do people get that, and what do you suggest they get other than that to look at?
I think Forks Over Knives was like the documentary that started it all. And who would have known? When we were working on that film, who would have known it really would have started a whole genre of films? But it's still the grandfather of them all. It was done in, I think we made it 2009, 2010. It was in the theaters in 2011. That's a great one to watch. Food Choices is my most recent one, and it's a great film. It addresses the broader issue of how our food choices affect not only our personal health, but what we're doing to our finances, to the environment. And I mean, we all tend to think of ourselves, because humans are, in addition to being messy, humans are selfish little critters. We think of ourselves first, but we actually are all pretty connected to each other and the planet we live on, so we should think about that too. So that's a good resource. And then, you know, I kind of like my book, Food Over Medicine. I think it's a good one. So those would be some resources on our website. And I put out a newsletter every week and video clips. People can get a college education three times a week with content that we put out for free that people can sign up for, too.
You see, folks, it's actually impossible to have a conversation for more than 30 seconds with Pam Popper, my guest, without learning something. And I'm just learning and learning. I'm a novice in this whole area. And my gosh, you just fill me up with new information. Remember our conference. I'm going to be having Pam on a couple of more times before the conference, and it's toward the end of November. It's in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus is a nice place, folks. November 10th, 11th, and 12th. Look it up by looking up Pam Popper, or go to Bregan.com and you'll find it. I want to say, Pam, you're really just having a marvelous effect on my life and career. People have often in the past asked me questions about, you know, what else to do other than improving your mental health with, you know, exercise and three square meals a day and good principles of living, like my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. You know, what are we supposed to do? Get a good therapist and so on. And the most important answer is what Pam Popper's offering, which is a scientifically based diet, which to eating. I don't even think we should call it diet. Scientifically based eating, which goes back to eating as humans have always eaten. You can have some meat if you want. Probably no dairy. And really learn how to eat the basic animal product. I mean, vegetable products, plant products. Pam, the music came upon me faster than I thought. Thank you, Pam Popper.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks,
this
for listening.
Fun.
Thanks for listening. Bye, everybody.